Evening, folks. Yeah, there we go. That was nice and friendly, wasn't it? It's good to see you. For whom is this their first time accreditation? Welcome. Yeah, good to have you. Yeah. Because, you know, we've had a lot of sessions so far already. You know, you've missed out on at least a week. And this is, you know, actually, I'm sorry, you had missed out on half the series. And this is the very last night. So tonight we are finishing our two-part series on God and stuff. And I want to start by just noting that it is really hard to avoid the fact that Christianity makes certain exclusive claims, that is, claims about its uniqueness, exclusive claims about Jesus, about us and about God, and in particular, the great exclusive claim that there is a terrible gulf between we humans and God that can only be bridged by Jesus. That's an exclusive claim. That's a unique claim about Jesus. So Jesus himself is recorded as saying, "I am the way and the truth and the life, and no one comes to the Father except through me." But one of the things I find as I talk to genuinely thoughtful and open-minded inquirers, and I have lots of conversations with people about the claims of Jesus, as I talk to genuinely thoughtful and open-minded inquirers, whether they be university students or university professors, professionals or full-time parents, taxi drivers or tradespeople, again and again, they point to these exclusive claims about the uniqueness of Jesus for the salvation of humanity as a source of real, genuine, heartfelt difficulty. That's because, I take it, at least in part, there is no escaping the fact that an exclusive claim, something that's exclusive, means something that excludes. And the exclusive Christian claims are claims that exclude other claims, other worldviews, if you like. And when you exclude a worldview, what you're not just doing, make no mistake, you're not simply excluding a set of ideas that float out there in the marketplace of thought. But what you also exclude, in some sense, is all those people to whom those worldviews are part of their most fundamental identity. You draw lines in the sand. But these aren't play lines. These are lines which actually divide real people from one another. And we've seen time and time again in history what arises from this kind of division. But you know, the other thing that I've discovered is that it's not just those who are investigating the claims of Jesus and maybe hoping that he is who he claims to be who run a little bit of ground here. I've also talked regularly to Christians. Christians have become totally convinced that Jesus really is their king and their saviour, and who even so have found the exclusive claims to his uniqueness a bit of a rocket patch. They look at their friends, their friends who profess other religions and worldviews or none at all. They love them. And they can't help noticing that often as they look upon their friends, they see they live lives that are, in the end, morally superior to their own. And they wonder what kind of claims could justify dividing that person from themselves then. They find it uncomfortable to make or to pass on any exclusive claims of Jesus. And they find themselves slow, therefore, to take any steps which might lead to them trying to introduce that person to Jesus for the first time. Now tonight we come to a passage from the Gospel of Matthew, one of the biographies of Jesus. An amazing passage. Now, to be perfectly honest, I think this is possibly my favourite passage in the whole Bible. I think it is just incredible. It is inescapably powerful. And we come tonight to this passage, I think partly because this passage takes us to the very heart of this question. It draws us in and brings us face to face with this issue that we're confronting tonight. And this, I think, surprises many of us. It takes us there because in this passage, we don't find a questioner or a believer struggling with the exclusive claims of Jesus. We find Jesus himself, Jesus, wrestling with this very question. And let me put it into a really concrete form so we know what the question is that Jesus is wrestling with. The question that Jesus is wrestling with, this very question, is something like, is the only way that the loving God may offer salvation to the whole world or even to a single person, the suffering and crucifixion and death of Jesus, his one and only Son? Now, if you're a writer, if you like to kind of jot that down, this is a great thing to jot down to hang the talk on this, because this is the question I think this passage unpacks for us. Is the only way that the loving God may offer salvation to the whole world or even to a single person, the suffering and crucifixion and death of Jesus, his one and only Son? And what brings to light the fact that this is something that Jesus is struggling with is we see in this passage that we've had read to us this evening that Jesus is terrified. Jesus is terrified. Let's dive in and see. In Matthew 26, verse 36, we read, "Then Jesus went with his disciples to a place called Gethsemane, and he said to them, 'Sit here while I go over there and pray.'" Now, if you've read any of the Gospels or heard some of the stories, there is nothing new at all about the idea that Jesus might go away from crowds for a while to pray. In fact, this was his usual habit. Either he got up early in the morning, which I know is incomprehensible enough to most of you, but sometimes it was his regular habit to actually go away in the evening and spend all night, and suddenly you can relate. He would spend all night, but in this case, by himself. A whole night in an isolated place, just him and his Father God. And in this case, the place he goes to is an enclosed olive grove called Gethsemane, from the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, east out the city gates, out of the city, down to the bottom of the valley, the Hebron Valley, and then just up the other side, the Mount of Olives, a place called Gethsemane. What's different? Okay, what is glaringly different is this time, for the first time, and the only time, Jesus takes company with him. And I think we can get why. You see, when you're in a bit of a grey spot, you're in a funk, what you really want to do is you want to go to your room and shut the door and have some time out to yourself, okay, and play some bad music. Okay? A grey spot wants to be enjoyed alone, just to dwell in your melancholy. Anyone else like dwelling in melancholy every now and again? Just doing a few laps in a pool of gloom. When you're in a grey spot, you want to be alone. But the long, dark midnight of the soul needs company, needs to be shared. Verse 37, Jesus took Peter and the two sons of Zebedee, James and John, along with him, and he began to be sorrowful and troubled. And then he said to them, "My soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death. Stay here and keep watch with me." You kind of get a sense now for why Jesus actually wants company. There is something that has affected him so deeply that he is just emotionally spent and crushed. It's like the great existential steamroller of life has just backed over him a few times. Nowhere else, save perhaps in the very last moments that he experiences on the cross, nowhere else do we find Jesus just so devastated and so destroyed. My soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death. He is so grieved. His heart is so torn apart that Jesus, who is not given to melodrama, he says, it is like being almost dead. And so he pleads with his friends to stand vigil with him. And verse 39, going a little farther, he fell with his face to the ground and he prayed, "My Father, if it is possible, may this cup be taken from me, yet not as I will, but as you will." And this prayer is the crux of the whole passage. And in fact, the crux to our understanding how Jesus wrestles with this entire issue. It's a crucial prayer. Three times we see Jesus actually, he returns from his lazy, soft, hopeless disciples. Three times he goes to the same spot. He prays exactly the same words. He falls on his face as he prays them. It was pretty usual for people to come and fall their face at his feet, to fall before him, pleading with him that he might heal them, falling before his feet in worship. But here, Jesus falls on his face before his Father, saying this prayer three times, a prayer on the very ragged edge. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to take this prayer and I'm going to look at it from two perspectives. I'm going to break it into two pieces. So important is it for us to understand. Okay, two pieces. First bit, Jesus asks, "May this cup be taken from me. May this cup be taken from me." What is he talking about? What cup? Okay, he's in a garden by himself. Oh, well, he's got some mates over the corner, but they're asleep. "May this cup be taken from me." Now, a little bit of background is going to be really helpful here. Firstly, you need to understand that throughout the scriptures, throughout the Bible, there are passages in which God promises through his prophets, his human mouthpieces, that the day will come when God will set right everything that is broken on the earth. He will bring his kingdom. He will bring justice. A God who does not bring justice ultimately is a God not worth worshipping. And the promise is the day will come, the day that the Bible calls the day of the Lord, the day of judgment, when he promises to defeat evil, to overthrow all those who persecute and who oppress all those who do wickedness in the earth. What comes, I think, as a shock to us Westerners, us pluralistic, dispassionate, inoculated against great claims Westerners, is it included in this biblical category of those who do evil? Are those who do evil by failing to rightly honour the one true God? The God who made them. The God who made us. The God who gave us life and breath and all that we are. The God who provides all of our needs and everything that we enjoy. And before you react to that's Old Testament religion. That's primitive, thuggish religion. You got to keep in mind that Jesus, kind, loving, gentle Jesus, speaks more about this judgment than anyone else. And he does that because judgment is a necessary part of love. Have you ever seen anyone whom you really love be hurt? I have. And let me tell you, real love seeks justice and judgment upon that which hurts, those who hurt the ones you love. Love cannot be cut off from judgment. Love and anger, love and judgment are not opposites. Not even love and hate. Okay, don't get that wrong. Love and hate are not opposites. Love and indifference are opposites. Love and laziness are opposites. And about 31 times in the Old and New Testament, a particular image is coupled with God's judgment, and that is the image of a cup. So, for example, in Psalm 75, we read just a single verse, I'll quote it. "In the hand of the Lord is a cup. In the hand of the Lord is a cup full of foaming wine mixed with spices," which sounds good so far. It's like mulled wine on a cold, rainy autumn day. "In the hand of the Lord is a cup full of foaming wine mixed with spices. He pours it out and all the wicked of the earth drink it down to its very dregs. Suddenly the story is not as cheerful. You see, the cup is actually an image of God's anger against evil. The cup is an image of God's judgment. It's a really powerful image because when you drink a cup, you take it down into yourself. And the image of the cup is that those who are wicked will drink from the cup of God's judgment and anger, and it is this cup that Jesus prays will be taken from him, which I hope you see appears to make absolutely no sense. Okay? It is a weird idea. Why? Why is it a strange idea? Well, because remember, this cup is the cup of wrath, of God's righteous, holy, perfect judgment upon a wicked and rebellious humanity. But what is this cup doing before Jesus? Jesus isn't wicked. Jesus isn't rebellious. In fact, even those who don't believe the claims that Jesus makes about himself tend to regard him as one of the paragons of humanity, one of the great examples of kindness and gentleness and patience and tolerance, don't they? Why would the cup of the judgment of God on the wickedness of humanity be in front of Jesus? The answer is, of course, that Jesus, the Son of God, the one true and only, truly innocent human being, Jesus has stepped up in order to drink that cup so that you and I wouldn't have to. So 700 years beforehand, the prophet Isaiah foretold in what is one of the great and famous passages of the scriptures, Isaiah 53 verse 5 I'll read from, "He was pierced for our transgressions, he was crushed for our iniquities, the punishment that brought us peace was upon him. And by his wounds we are healed. We all, like sheep, have gone astray. We each of us has turned to our own way. And the Lord has laid on him the iniquity," which means sin, the rebellion, "of us all." In other words, Jesus is the one who has come to bear our punishment. He is the one who has come to carry God's wrath for us, to bear our guilt, to stand in our place, to drink our cup. The cup that we ought to drink, Jesus has come to drink. And to drink that cup, it's an image of taking all the judgment of every act of evil born in his own body on the cross tomorrow night. The second perspective on this prayer. I don't think it should shock us when we really think about it, but I think it often does. Jesus says in his prayer, "May this cup be taken from me." Do you see what Jesus is asking? Jesus is looking for a way out. Jesus is no Socrates who, as he drinks the poison chalice, tells his friends not to cry. Jesus is looking for a way out. The cross is no magic trick. It's no divine sleight of hand. On the cross, a real person will be betrayed and abandoned and abused and tortured and beaten and nailed to a post through their very bones and muscle and sinew and left to die. But worse than that, on that day, Jesus, the only true Son of God, Jesus, who since the beginning of eternity has been in a perfect, intimate, united, loving relationship with his Father, will on that day, on the cross, instead find that relationship ripped apart, and instead of love will find all the anger of that same Father, the righteous and heavenly God, all the anger for all the selfish and callous acts of billions of human beings dumped upon him. In order that he and his Father, in a unity of will and purpose, might save some of those same ignorant, unaware human beings, even as they carry on in their daily lives. But now Jesus is looking for a way out. He's looking for a way out. Keep in mind, guys, it's not that his love for you and I is kind of faltering. It's not that his trust in his Father has ever wavered, even for a moment. He isn't in this dark midnight of his soul considering abandoning us. He isn't bailing out. Do you see what his prayer is? He says to his Father, again and again, he says, let your will be done. He's saying, let's do this thing. Let's complete this great plan. Let's save the world. He trusts that his Father will do the right thing, even in the face of the horror of tomorrow night. But what Jesus wants to know as he prays to his Father, what he wants to know in this moment of darkness is this: is there any other way? Is there any other way for this goal to be achieved? Is there some other way that these billions could be rescued from their sin and their rebellion and their darkness and their damage? Isn't there some other way? Couldn't they just be good? Couldn't they just be sincere? Couldn't they just love God or love people? Couldn't they just go to Credo public meeting, small group and ETC? Wouldn't that do it? Of all things. Couldn't they just go on pilgrimage or never kill or harm another living thing or maybe give generously to the poor or offer sacrifices to a priesthood or a temple? Couldn't they just do one of these things? Wouldn't it do? Isn't it possible, Jesus is asking, isn't it possible that there is a way to pay for all the sins of humanity without the only Son of God, innocent and pure, to be utterly shattered on the cross? Isn't there another way? That's Jesus' prayer to his Father. Your will be done, Father. Let's save this world. But isn't there another way apart from the cross? And friends, don't you think that as his Son in anguish and terror prayed to him in this night in Gethsemane, don't you think on this night, if there were another way, a way which didn't involve the agony of his only dear beloved Son, don't you think that if there was another way, God would have found it and taken that instead? The house I live in, we've only been living in for a little bit over a year. And when we arrived, we discovered that the house had been lived in beforehand by people whom I would generously describe as yahoos. They thought that a fun Friday, Saturday, well, let's be honest, Monday night, was to get very, very drunk and to throw beer bottles against the walls of the houses on either side of our garden. And so when we arrived with our four small children, we discovered that rather we'll turn up at the back door with a handful of pieces of glass. Ideally, it's a handful. Sometimes he'll have one or two pieces in his feet as well. And he'll say, here, it's for the recycling, Daddy, as he collects more glass from the garden. And you know what glass does when you stick it. It's uncomfortable, but you pull it out again and there's a little bead of blood. And that's all it is usually. But one day, my daughter Rose, who was then about 4 years old, stepped on a piece of glass which went in and broke off. We didn't know it about the time, and we didn't discover this till later, but a little piece of glass went in, it broke off, and by an unfortunate set of occurrences, it got really badly infected so that her toe began to swell up. She was having minor fevers. It was incredibly uncomfortable. We went into RPA one night and, they gave some stuff and they had a little look at it and they tried to clean out the wound a little bit and they said, come back if there are any problems. And the next day it was worse than ever. And so we went into RPA to the emergency. We went into the pediatric emergency ward. We waited there for a while and then they took us out the back. And this began what I honestly think is possibly my worst ever experience as a dad. I honestly think it was the worst experience ever. See, on this night, a doctor and two nurses took my little daughter with me out to one of the rooms where there was a bed, and they laid her on the bed, and I stood by her head, and there were two nurses, and there was a doctor, and the doctor asked us to hold my daughter down. And they got a little knife, and they sliced open her little toe, my four-year-old daughter, and they squeezed. They had to squeeze all the pus out and to scrape it out from her toe, and she was screaming in agony. She was writhing, and I had to hold her down. And there came a point when she was just so distressed at what was, for her, an unbelievable experience of torture. She was in such pain that she looked up to her, and tears were running from her eyes. And she looked up to her with a red face with wild eyes. And she looked at the only person in the room who she trusted, who she knew had the power to get her out of this. And she said, "Daddy, please make them stop. Please make them stop. And I will carry that moment with me." As I looked at her, I will carry that moment with me. "Daddy, please make them stop." And don't you think that if there was any other way for her to be healed, don't you think that there's any other way for her toe to be treated? Don't you think that if I knew there were some people somewhere and they had my daughter and stuff was being done to her for no other reason but for the aesthetics of life or because they could, don't you think I would find something else? Don't you think if there's any other way for her to be protected from septicemia that I would have found it? I would have raced out and grabbed a garbage truck like Hollywood and backed it through the wall of RPA to rescue her. I would have grabbed a chair and swung it wildly around and threatened some crucial medical staff with scalpels or something. Don't you think I would have done that? Because that's what dads do. Okay? That's what dads do. If there was any other way, do you think I would have let her go through another second of that? Just another moment? Well, Jesus is no four-year-old girl. He is not a victim of someone's carelessness. He is there because he has come in full agreement with his Father. But on this night, he pleads with his Father, "Father, isn't there some other way? Isn't there some other way to clean the wounds of this world? Some other way to heal its brokenness? Some other way to save it from its poison? Isn't there some other way?" "If there is some other way, Daddy, make it stop." But Jesus goes to the cross. You see, friends, this is why Christians aren't embarrassed about making and passing on the exclusive claims, the claims about the uniqueness of Jesus Christ for the salvation of humanity. It isn't because Christians think they are better or cleverer or better educated or wiser than anyone else. In fact, the very claims that Jesus make it impossible to make those claims at the same time. This isn't some kind of cultural imperialism. It isn't arrogance. It's not blindness. I can look around. I can see the rich beauty of the Hindu Bhagavad Gita. I am deeply moved by the merits of the Buddhist life. I see my atheist friends, and I respect their moral fibre in pursuing a life doing good for others just because they think it's right to do good to others. And I recognise in my Muslim friends a discipline and a passion that I cannot help but admire. But friends, if what any of these our friends did or do, whether it is religious or irreligious, if anything these friends do works to deal with the most basic problems of our alienation from God and our problem of sin, if any of these worked, do you really think that the loving God would have allowed the delight of his heart, his one and only Son, to suffer on the cross for us? If even one of these worked, one religion, one creed, one system, one habit of behaviour, one act of sincerity, don't you think that if one of them worked, then God would have pointed to that instead, grabbed it, run with it, and said, "This is the way"? Because, of course, if the there is another way, what does it make God that he lets his son die? Here is the truth, friends. Jesus died for our sins because nothing else worked. Nothing else would make our sins washed away. Nothing else would deal with our brokenness and our alienation from the one true God of life. Nothing else would work. And that is why Jesus went to the cross. And it's worth just pausing for a moment and keeping in mind that on this night the cup is set before him, but Jesus didn't have to take it. The cup of God's wrath is set before him, and Jesus could have daubed Judas in. Jesus might have run away. And yet, as you read in the next few passages of the biography of Jesus in Matthew, he actually turns and he faces it. He does not run away. Three times he stops people from letting him escape. See, when Jesus sees that cup, after he has prayed to his Father and been assured that there is no other way, he takes that cup. And he doesn't just sip at it. He takes it with both hands and he drinks it down. Every last drop of the anger of God, Jesus takes down into himself so that you and I need not even taste it. That is what Jesus does. He drinks it all. And so I say to Christians, you know what? You're probably right. Your friends almost certainly are more admirable than you in almost every respect. But what they are doing does not work. Or Jesus would not have died on the cross. And if you are someone here tonight and you're exploring and you're listening to the claims of Jesus, then you need to be reminded of this wonderful truth, that there is one who came from God, God himself, who came to drink the cup of God's wrath in your place, the cup that you deserved. And he did not just drink some. He did not come just to share it with you, to go halvesies. Jesus came to take that cup and to drink every last drop so that you wouldn't even have to taste it. And that's what Christians call good news.